So tonight I want to speak about awareness as a lifestyle. You know, when we first hear the Dharma, or we hear the instructions on how to practice mindfulness, or the value of mindfulness, we hear these instructions and then we pick up some technique or some idea of something we have to do, and we make this effortful and intentional techniquing to be mindful or to become mindful, and it's usually aimed towards having some kind of spiritual experience or some spiritual goodies, even if it's just calming down or de-stressing. And so a lot of effort goes into achieving or acquiring some kind of experience different than what we have been experiencing, which is why we came to practice in the first place. But actually, once there's a momentum in practice and after we have some experience experimenting with mindfulness, there's this thing called the momentum of practice, or the momentum of mindfulness, or living with awareness. So I want to talk about this, the evolution of this effortful, directed activity to, as it matures and becomes a way of life. Because one of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, a monk from Burma, he says, you know, we should consider meditation and the development of wisdom more as a marathon rather than a sprint. And while we in America, like America and here in the West, like to sprint, we like to get things done quick, efficiently, purposefully, meditation and the development of wisdom doesn't work that way. It is more a marathon, meaning, and it's not even a 26-mile marathon, it's the rest of your life marathon. So sometimes when we think, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to do this the rest of my life, we might think, what would you ever want to do for the rest of your life? Well, developing awareness is something that you might consider. And in this process, of course, there's many ups and downs. There's a lot of different terrain that we're going to run into, both difficult and rewarding. There's a lot of pitfalls to the practice, and there's a lot of spiritual goodies to be experienced. And nobody can't do it. There's no one that doesn't have the capacity to be aware. Even if you're taking medications that kind of make it possible for you to live your life with some ease, they don't interfere with the mind working. And the mind can still be aware. So we should consider that whatever we're doing in our life, whether we're raising family or very busy at work, as we all are, or are retired, you can practice awareness. And in this development of awareness, there are what are called the five controlling faculties, the five activities of mind that are most responsible for guiding the unfolding of your practice. So I want to speak about them tonight. And the first of these faculties of mind, they're, we might call them mental muscles. They're capacities of the mind, they're attributes of the mind, they're activities of mind that can be developed and are developed through practice. And just like developing and taking care of our body, if we go to the club and we do our exercises, you know, when I said this a while back, when we go to the club and do our exercises, and some younger people in the group said, what do you mean go to the club? I go to the club to drink. What do you do? And I forgot, oh, right. There's a generational thing there. Clubs for people my age are where you go to stay healthy and keep your physique up a little bit. So when you go to the club and you do your reps, you know, your repetitions, sometimes you have to use muscles that you don't even know you have. But once you develop them to a degree, then they're available for you when you need them to carry the groceries or to climb stairs or to do other things that you need to do in life. Well, mental muscles are like that too. We undertake a certain training to develop these mental muscles, not just so that the muscles get big and you look handsome or your mind looks beautiful, but we develop these muscles so that they're available to us as we live our life. So these five controlling faculties are the five spiritual faculties. The first one is sadha in the Pali language of the Buddhist teachings, and that means, generally it's translated as faith, but as a verb, as an activity of mind, it's really trusting. Having some faith or having some trust, having some confidence, and trusting both yourself, trusting a teacher, trusting the practice. And with trust, we're able to and willing to make some effort. Energy is the second of these factors, or virya. And we might say, oh, this is energizing. But actually, I think a more nuanced understanding of what we mean by the effort of practice is patience. Patience and persevering. And if we can strike a balance in our efforting between being patient with the way things are that not always to our liking, but being persistent or persevering in our remembering to be mindful, then we will proceed at the right pace. We won't proceed so fast that we get caught in striving, and we won't be procrastinating, but we'll be persevering patiently. And when we do persevere in our practice, we will remember more often. Remembering is the function of this mental factor, mindfulness. So I'm speaking about awareness tonight. You know, usually when you hear Dharma teachers speaking about mindfulness, we're speaking about the activity of mindfulness. Well, tonight I'm going to use the word awareness for the activity of mindfulness, and I'm going to use the word mindfulness for one function within awareness. And the function that mindfulness serves is to remember. And it's to remember the present moment. It's to remember to recognize the present moment. We don't have to make the present moment happen. It happens due to its own causes and conditions. The present moment has been happening forever, and it doesn't stop. And we have lived out of the present moment most of our lives. We've lived within the present moment. But that doesn't mean that we're aware or that we remember to recognize the present moment. So what we're doing is we're cultivating a particular mental muscle of remembering to recognize the present moment, not just to be absorbed in the present moment. And when we remember with more frequency or greater continuity, then it stabilizes the mind. Now, when I'm talking about stabilizing the mind, you know, when the mind is scattered, or when the mind is dispersed, or when the mind is multitasking all day long, it really gets fragmented. It gets dispersed. It gets thin. It doesn't have much power. And what remembering to recognize the present moment does is it stabilizes the mind. It collects the mind from all of the dispersion. So every time you have think of it this way. You know, when you get a new catalog in the mail, or you go online looking for something, every time you turn a page of a catalog, you're presented with 6 or 8 or 10 things that your mind has to look at and decide yes, no, or maybe to every item on that page. You can't just kind of turn the page and not look. You're looking at a catalog. You're looking to see if there's something there that you might need after 20, 30, 40 years of not needing it. There might be something there that you now need. But your mind gets dispersed. A little bit of your mind sticks on every one of those objects that you see, and you get to page 60 of the catalog, you finally close the cover and you say, your mind is gone. It's stuck on the page. It's stuck on all those objects. Well, the same thing happens in our life when we contact people and things and events and the news and billboards and music and everything that calls our attention. It calls our attention away from remembering to recognize the present moment. We get absorbed in, we get lost in the experiences of our life. And the mind that is lost or dispersed or restlessly wandering over the events of life is quite powerless to the seduction of desire and aversion. So we say that that mind is unstable. It's easily manipulated. It's easily caught in reactivity. It has no strength. But when the mind is stabilized, it's collected, it's not so dispersed, then it is remembering the present moment, but it's not remembering it in the usual way, because the collected mind sees things more clearly. It understands things more accurately. So while we may be looking at the familiar events of our life, in practice it's often the breath, or sensations that are occurring in the body, or our thoughts. Same old thoughts, same old breath, same old experiences of the body, but because the mind is more collected, more less dispersed, more powerful, we see and understand familiar experiences differently. And this is the practice of insight. So the interesting thing about these five factors of mind, these five controlling faculties, is that they have a cause-effect relationship. If faith or trusting arises, it is the cause for the effect of making effort. If making effort or having energy for awareness arises, it is the cause for greater mindfulness or greater remembering. If there's more remembering or more continuity to remembering, then it stabilizes the mind. This is called samadhi. And if the mind is more collected and stabilized, less dispersed, it sees and understands things more deeply, more accurately. And when we understand, when we see, when we get that glimpse of, aha, that's how it is. That's how I get caught in anger, irritation, frustration, disappointment, desire. Once we understand that about ourselves, we feel more inspired, more trusting, more confident to make more effort. And in this way, gradually, sequentially, and cyclically, these five faculties or five factors develop and mature and come into balance. Now you might think, yeah, but I'm not very mindful. Maybe not yet. But you know that you can remember to recognize the present moment. That's a mental muscle that can be trained. What we do with practice is train and develop these mental muscles. So I want to speak about each one of these activities of mind, each of these factors, in a little more detail so that you can begin to recognize them in your own practice, your own life, and you can begin to understand them so that you can look at where you are in your own practice, and you can begin to recognize when you're out of balance, and you can begin to bring the factors of that control your practice or that guide your practice, you can begin to bring them into balance so that you can continue to proceed on this path and journey of awakening. As I mentioned, the first factor is saddha, or trusting, or having faith in some aspect of the practice. Well, when I first started Dhamma practice, it was an accident. I didn't know anybody who meditated. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I wasn't interested in spiritual practice. I was in a commune that was dedicated to the Grateful Dead. And And that was my spiritual practice, partaking of the sacrament and listening to dead and going to dead shows whenever possible. But someone in the commune saw this little book, Beginning to See, little one-liners about mindfulness. It wrote to the address in the back about how to get the opportunity to practice. And she was told that, oh, there was a retreat going on in Bucksport, Maine, which was just an hour and a half from where we lived in central Maine, where this practice of mindfulness was being taught. So she decided that she wanted to go for a two-week retreat. I thought she said she was going on something like a resort for a holiday. And I said, oh, I could use that. I'd like to do that. So I signed up too. And we went to, on the appointed day, we went to Bucksport, Maine, to an old Catholic monastery in the middle of a raging snowstorm the day after we went to Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review concert. Anyway, we arrived at the meditation center, or the monastery, and 50 people had been practicing for 2.5 months, because this was the first three-month retreat that Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg offered in Bucksport, Maine. And the last 2 weeks of it was open to new students. So we walked in, and on the left was a dining room, and the notice on the door that said, new arrivals will meet at 4:30 to register. And on the right, there was the chapel. And we looked inside, and there were people sitting in there. And it was cold. It was in the winter. And they'd been there for 2.5 months. They were all wrapped up in blankets. And when they come out, they weren't looking at us. They were shuffling around like, you know how people shuffle around on retreats? They're all wrapped up in blankets. They don't look at you. They don't talk. We thought, what have we got ourselves into here? We looked at the schedule on the door. You know, it says, wake up, 4 o'clock, you know, do your yoga, do a sitting, do some walking, have breakfast, sit, walk, lunch, sit, walk, sit, walk, sit, tea, sit, walk, sit, 7:30, talk. Then sit, walk, go to bed. And we looked at each other and said, at least we get an hour a day to talk. What that meant was we got an hour a day to listen. So we were surprised, and it was torture, because I'd never sat cross-legged. I'd never meditated 1 minute in my life before I went to do 2 weeks. And it was just absolutely excruciating in the body, and it was not much better in the mind, because, you know, the mind was not very collected. But one thing really struck me about that retreat. When I heard the Dharma talks in the evening that were speaking about the Dharma, which is really the way things are. That's what the Dharma means. The truth, the way things are. It's the teachings of the Buddha pointing to the way things are. When I heard those talks in the evening, it was as if I heard someone speaking for the first time what I'd always known to be true. And so I got off on it. I got lit up with, how do they know? How do they know what's going on in my mind? This is exactly how I understand things to be. And what happened after that retreat, after that 14 days, went back to the commune. And of course, you know, when you come out of retreat, you don't notice that anything has happened. You're in retreat, you're dealing with your mind and your body, and, you know, you think you're normal. Well, you're as normal as you ever were, which wasn't very normal. But when we went back to the commune at the end of the retreat, everybody was doing the same thing. It was the same people doing the same thing. And we looked at it, and we were in a totally different space. We had such a different perspective on what was going on because of the work we'd done becoming familiar with our own mind. Well, since that time, my life has been pretty much devoted to practicing the Dharma for 10 years, doing retreats at the Meditation Center in Massachusetts when it opened a year later, and then teaching. So what happened? What happened to that retreat? I didn't have any interest in Buddhism. I didn't know anything about meditation. My faith got awakened. my trust in myself, my trust in that practice, my trust in these teachings got lit up because I heard the Dharma. And that awakening of faith was enough for me to make 10 years of effort doing retreats and going on staff at the meditation center. That's what bright faith does. It inspires you. It transports you to another sense of yourself. And from that, we can then move into our practice. Now, about a year and a half after I did that retreat, now I'd only done a two-week retreat, I went to the meditation center in Massachusetts that was looking for people to come do some work there. And one of my first days working at this retreat center, I was up in the attic of one of the dormitories with Rodney Smith, in fact. He was on staff at the time, and we were insulating the top of a dormitory. And now remember, I'd done one retreat for 2 weeks, and we were having a discussion about Nibbana, like I knew something about Nibbana, didn't know anything about Nibbana. But Rodney reminded me several years ago now, he said that he was surprised that when we were having that discussion then, I exclaimed to him with utter and absolute faith and certainty, I have no doubt that I will realize the Dharma in this lifetime. I had no idea what I was saying. I had no idea what was going to be involved in doing that, but I had faith. Faith doesn't rely on knowledge. It relies on this inner knowing that, of course, you still have to work at to realize it. Faith is not wisdom. Faith is the aspiration for wisdom. And so it takes some work to do that. But with faith, we have a sense of where we're going. They say that the function of faith is to clarify our spiritual objective. Now, some might think that means, we get an idea of what the goal is and we should strive for the goal. But really, our spiritual aspiration is not a goal so much as a direction. We should understand that in any moment, we can reorient ourselves to our spiritual aspiration. If we see where we're off track or we find ourselves in the ditch, we can go, wait a minute. I want to be heading in this direction and get back on the track. To strive for the goal of whatever you imagine that goal is putting a lot of pressure on the mind. And really what our spiritual objective is and where our faith is in the direction that we're going. And that we can reorient to at any time. So when we have this kind of faith, and we're willing to make some effort, then we can proceed on the path. But faith alone is not enough, because we've had faith. Many of you have faith. Many of you had faith in other things. But there might not have been the spark that gets you to move with your faith. And it's said that the approximate cause for making effort or for arousing the energy to act on your faith, the approximate cause is having a sense of urgency. If you have faith, but you don't have any urgency in your life to act on it, it doesn't go anywhere. So having a sense of urgency, like now is the time, now I really need it, now is the time. Samvega is that sense of quickening in the heart that maybe you don't understand something, maybe you recognize that there's something more to be realized or discovered in life. One of the traditional Samvega, the spiritual urgency, one of the causes for it is often the loss of someone or a pet or some disappointment in life where, you know, the security that you've had, the way you've known things to be, the trust that you've had is gone. Somebody dies, your pet dies, you get jilted by a lover, you your career falls apart or something, and you're just left with this emptiness. Then the heart really starts looking for, all right, what's this life all about? What is it I'm supposed to be doing here in life? And that kind of question is what can draw you to and pull you towards practice. When we make an effort to practice awareness, you know how it is when you're practicing or you're doing a 45-minute sitting, or if you're on retreat, you know, this is a visual teaching, okay? So we're practicing and we're breathing in, we're breathing out, we're noticing this, we're noticing that, the mind is wandering off, we're noticing this, we're noticing that. We got pain in the body and we're just kind of with the pain in the body. And up until this point, we're just kind of noticing, and sometimes things get overbearing, they get too painful, they get too boring, they get too something, and the mind goes, collapses. Where the mind collapses its effort. It said that the manifestation of right effort is non-collapse. So this is where the understanding that right effort is just persevering, just staying with, being willing to open to this, to experience this, no matter what it is, not collapsing. Well, I had a really powerful teaching of this function of right effort when I was in the monastery in Burma. After I'd done 10 years of retreats, I finally realized I didn't know how to be mindful. I didn't know what mindfulness was about. I was an utter failure, and I got to confess, I am a really slow learner. I mean, really slow learner. After 10 years, I still didn't know what mindfulness was. But I had another one of those spiritual urgency, faith arousing, now is the time experiences. I was on retreat. I was doing a retreat over my birthday, which I always did at the meditation center. And about the third or fourth day in the retreat, I was lying down, actually. I think I was meditating. I could have been doing other things, but I was meditating. And I had this vision. And I'm not a woo-woo-wow-wow guy. I am not a visionary. I'm not a bhakti type. I don't have woo-woo-wow-wows happen to me at all. But I had this vision. And this vision came to me, and it was of a shrouded female figure. And when I looked at her face in the shroud, it was just a skeleton. And the message from her was, the moment of death is the most important moment of your life. When I heard that, I had this instant recognition that I needed to practice more, and that's all I wanted to do in life. And even though I was 35 at the time and I was just getting my adult career kind of off the ground and was becoming successful enough to support myself comfortably, I decided that wasn't really what was needed. I needed something else. I needed to understand something about myself that I didn't yet understand. And only awareness, that as I'd understood it to that point, was going to offer me that. So I went to the monastery in Burma, ordained, and I was practicing there, not knowing how long I would stay, but many of my friends, Rodney and Guy Armstrong and others, had been to Thailand and Burma and practiced for a year or two as a monk, and had gotten some benefit, so I was there thinking similarly. I'd been practicing for, I don't know if it was my first year or my second year. And I remember I was walking on the hallway in this dormitory, this little bungalow dormitory where the foreign monks were staying. And I was walking in the back corridor, and I was just doing this slow motion walking. And I noticed something in my mind I'd never seen before. I'd never seen it. And it was a collapse of energy. and I was walking along, and it just... And when I saw that, I recognized that the voice of that mental state was, oh, poor me. Oh, poor me. I can't do this. I'm too stupid. Oh, poor me. I don't have any energy. Oh, poor me. I can't do this. I'm too old. Oh, poor me. I can't do this because whatever. And every time that thought, and it wasn't even a thought, it was just a feeling, came to my mind, I believed it and collapsed. Well, this was totally new to me. I'd never seen this in my mind before. I was still young and full of myself and pretty arrogant and confident, even if I was uninformed. But now I began to see something that was totally new, because it is the capacity of mindfulness to remember to recognize the present moment. And here was this momentum of mindfulness, recognizing the present moment, something that I'd never seen before. And when I saw this collapse into self-pity, I was like totally fascinated. And it was like, hey, look at this. Every time this unconscious, now becoming conscious, flavor runs through the mind, I collapse. So I roused my energy, and it was like I didn't let a moment go by when that state of mind or that feeling would arise. I'd be on it, recognizing it the instant it arose. And I don't know how long I noticed it, you know, maybe for a couple of weeks or a month, I'm not sure. But I was persistent to recognize it every time it came. Not out of aversion, but just I was so fascinated with how it kind of controlled my mind and collapsed my energy. So I was noticing, I noticed it. At some point, it stopped arising, and I haven't seen it since. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't had conditions in my life when I could say, she's so poor me. You know, there's all kinds of opportunities in life when we can feel self-pity, or we can just feel defeated, or we can want to collapse into, this is too hard. This is too overwhelming. This is beyond my capacity. I don't even want to do this. We all have these opportunities, lots. But when you see something like self-pity or any other, whatever your particular way of collapsing your energy is, mindfulness won't let you do that. Okay, so this right effort, again, is, you know, having a sense of urgency and not collapsing. And as we do that, then we become more continuously mindful. No one succeeds without effort, Ramana Maharshi says. Mind at peace is not your birthright. Those who succeed owe their liberation to perseverance. Another one of my teachers, Dharma teachers of the last century, feels funny to say the last century, I mean, we were just there a few years ago, was Don Juan in Carlos Castaneda's books. And you remember Carlos Castaneda was this naive graduate student kind of wandering around the Sonoran Desert, meeting shamans and taking cactus plants and tripping out with this wise man called Don Juan. Well, Carlos writes, Don Juan had assured me that in order to accomplish the feat of making myself miserable, I had to work in a most intense fashion, and that was absurd. Now I had come to realize that I could make myself and work to make myself strong and complete and whole. The truth is in what one emphasizes, Don Juan had said. We either make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves strong. The amount of work is the same. If we understand that, we can begin to recognize how much work it takes to make ourselves miserable. We work hard at it. We ruminate, we reflect, we think, we wallow persistently and make ourselves miserable. All that effort can be used to remember to recognize the present moment, to make the mind strong, to stabilize the mind, to awaken the mind to the way things really are. With that awakening, with that urgency, with that non-collapsing energy, then we become more mindful. Mindful, as I mentioned, is to remember to recognize the present moment's experience. Now, you'd think we sit down with all of our good intention, with good instruction, to pay attention to the present moment. Right? We sit down, close our eyes, take a breath, space out. That's not our intention. That's not what we'd hope to do, and not what we wanted to do, and yet it still happens. Well, that gives you an idea of just what we're up against. We're up against the habits of the mind to not remember. And so to remember is a mental muscle, sati. Now, when you develop sati, you don't have to go, you know, you don't have to focus on the breath here or focus on the breath here. You have to relax and remember this present moment. Remember to recognize this present moment. Remember again, remember again. Because the function, as I mentioned, of sati is to remember. Now, it's not difficult to be mindful in the sense of observing what's happening. What's difficult is to remember to observe. So observing is the manifestation. Once mindfulness or sati serves its function of remembering, it manifests as observing. So these are the two qualities of sati or mindfulness you want to remember. It's remembering the present moment to observe the present moment. And when we observe the present moment, we begin to recognize, taste its unique flavor. If we're just skimming along the top of our experience, not going very deeply into our experience, not spending any time on our experience, just letting them flow by, we don't really taste. It's like eating in a hurry. You can get the food in your belly, but what did you eat? Something. I'm not sure what. I wasn't paying attention. Well, what did it taste like? Well, I'm not sure. It was crunchy, though, so it wasn't a banana. But when we don't pay careful attention, meaning when we don't remember and we don't observe, we don't taste the essence of life. And when we don't taste the essence of life, we're forever hungry for more. Remember that second noble truth, or the first noble truth, the cause of dukkha or suffering is craving, wanting, not yet having tasted the flavor and gotten satisfied with that. So it is mindfulness that sees. It is this remembering and observing that will recognize what is familiar differently. You know, this idea of self-pity, that or this thought or this feeling of self-pity that I discovered late in life had been there, had arisen frequently in my life. It was a habit, but I had never seen it. This discovery is due to the continuity of sati, remembering and observing. So, several years ago now, 5 or 6, 7 or 8 years ago, I was working with a group in Portland, Oregon. And I would go see them now 4 or 5 times a year and spend a day with them. And I'd stay in the hotel in town, and then the next day would spend the day with them. And so I would come out of the hotel and go to a restaurant to have my breakfast. And there were just a lot of homeless people living in Portland at the time. Homeless people or panhandlers or street people, I'm not sure what, but there were a lot of them. And I wasn't very comfortable. I've always lived in ranchland, farmland. I haven't been around cities much, so I'm not familiar with, I'm not habituated to see a lot of panhandlers. But here I was in Portland, walking down the street. They were on both sides of the street. You couldn't avoid them. You couldn't walk across the street to avoid them. I tried to, but I felt uncomfortable. And after a few times of being in Portland like that, I realized, wow, I'm really not very comfortable. I'm a little afraid. I feel kind of like unnerved because I feel like they're kind of hitting on me for something, and I'm feeling my own judgments about their lifestyle. I don't trust them. There was just a lot of, my mindfulness was recognizing a lot of flavors of suffering that I was feeling. They weren't causing it. My mind was causing it. So when I realized that, I said, wow, I am really suffering. I'm not happy. I feel afraid, I feel anxious, I feel like I'd like to avoid these people. So I said, well, it's up to me to do something about it. It's not their responsibility to stop my suffering. It's my responsibility to address my suffering. So I made a practice of going up to these homeless people, panhandlers, and greeting them, just like they were a friend. And, hi, how are you? How's your day? What's going on? How are you doing today? And eventually to have a conversation with them, and then to ask them, well, what do you need? And I got some really interesting answers, but nevertheless, some people need a quarter to buy this, or they need a couple dollars to do their laundry, or they need a lot of people need bus tickets out of town. And some people just want to buy drugs. They want to get some beer, or they want some food. And but what I realized is, by recognizing my own fear, my own anxiety, my own discomfort, but addressing it and approaching them and having a conversation with them, I realized a couple of things. One is that they're all human. They're just humans. They're just ordinary humans. They have some difficult conditions in life to deal with, but don't we all? And once I began talking with them, mostly because I was approaching them out of interest in them and interest in my own reaction, they weren't hostile. They weren't fearful. It was very friendly, actually. And I would make a gesture of support. I would offer them a dollar or two, sometimes five, knowing that I can't solve their problems. I can't change their life, but I can be another human, acknowledging them as being worthy of connection. And that's the gift that we give whenever we practice generosity. Whatever it is we give is only incidental, secondary to the connection, the human heart connection of love, appreciation, acknowledgement. That's what we give with every gift. How do I know? You learn it, because mindfulness will tell you. Mindfulness will show you, oh, this is the way it is. Because mindfulness sees things without spin. If you turn on the news and you listen to, or more often now you watch a video clip on the radio, on the TV, or online, you see the video clip, 30-second video clip. Here's something that got caught, and you see there's somebody talking and something happens and somebody gets hurt and there's a big row and something, and you see and hear it for yourself. You know what happened. But after the video clip, the talking heads come on TV or on the online, and they talk about and they try to spin your understanding of what happened in their favor. Oh, this was a bad thing to do, or this is a good thing to do, or they said the right thing, they did the wrong thing, this person's to blame, whatever it is. But they are spinning their perspective on the news At the end of 30 minutes of listening to them, even though you saw the event for yourself, you don't know what you believe. Confused. You saw it, but you don't know. You don't realize what's actually going on there. Your mind has been spun so far in so many directions, you're not grounded anymore. We have had people spinning our minds since we were born, starting with mom and dad. They certainly wanted to spin your little young baby mind in their direction, because they're going to have to live with you. And if you're not kind of happy with them, they're not going to be happy either. Okay? And they pass off their responsibilities to teachers and the government and, you know, neighbors and relatives and anybody that will share the load. And so we're full of spin. We're full of views and opinions and ideas and conditioning of the way other people would like us to view the world and understand the world. When do we get to see our world, our life, without spin? Only if you practice mindfulness. If you don't practice mindfulness, you'll only see spin. Somebody's spin. Something you've learned from somebody else. But when you practice awareness, when you practice remembering to recognize this present moment and you actually taste the flavor of this moment through observing it with your own mind, then you know what this experience is. You know if it's pleasant or unpleasant. You know if it's wholesome or unwholesome. You know if it's skillful or unskillful. Nobody has to tell you. Because the stable mind from continuity of awareness sees things as they are, understands them as they are. But it takes a stable mind, a mind that is not spinning, a mind that is not caught in the restless agitation of internal debate. You know, the internal monologue that's going on all the time, that's just kind of narrating the way it is for you. This is not your mind. This is spin. And so the restless mind that is just wandering on and on and on, commenting about this and liking that and disliking this and expecting this and assuming that, is an unstable mind. It doesn't see things clearly. Or I should say, even if it sees things, it doesn't understand them correctly. Both deluded and ignorant. So with this mindfulness, the continuity of this remembering to recognize the present moment, the mind stabilizes. This stability of mind is called samadhi. This is the fourth of the spiritual faculties. Now, the interesting thing about concentration of mind, samadhi is sometimes called concentration. The interesting thing about concentration of mind is when we hear, you know, the instruction to focus or to stabilize the mind or to get concentrated, you know, we somehow think that somehow we have to, you know, grab our mind up here like this and focus it on our breath or on a sound or something and kind of hold it there to concentrate the mind. But that's not how you concentrate that mind. That's how you get a headache. Because the proximate cause for stability of mind is sukha. And sukha is happy comfort of mind and body. That means relax. Relax your body. Relax your mind. That is the proximate cause for collectedness and stability of mind. Samadhi. But somehow we get these instructions and we go off in another direction, struggling and striving to get concentrated, when in fact that's just the opposite of the source of stability of mind. So we want to remember to relax, to collect the mind in a gentle but persistent remembering moment by moment. So when the mind is collected, or as the mind gets collected, it's like looking through a magnifying lens. Your mind becomes a powerful lens, more powerful than ordinary day-to-day mind. So that when I say, I hold up my hand and I say, what do you see? You say, well, you see my hand. Yeah, but I say, well, get a little closer. And so you come and you look a little closer and you say, oh, I can see the lines on your hand. If I was a palm reader, I'd have something to say. But I can also see that you've got a lot of scars and you've got some stitches and a few things that these hands have taken a beating. That's true, they have. But we can see that. We know more about what we see when we get closer. And if we look through a magnifying lens at the hand, we'll see even more detail. And if we take a piece of tissue, put it under a microscope, we'll have a lot more detail and we'll lose the perspective that's familiar. Right? Well, the same thing happens when the mind gets collected through the continuity of remembering to recognize the present moment. The mind gets collected, becomes more powerful, takes a look at the, familiar experiences of our mind and our body, our thoughts, our beliefs, our aspirations, our hopes, our desires, our fears. It looks at these very ordinary experiences that we know very well, but it understands them very differently, because now we see more, we understand more, and therefore when we understand more, we're going to make different decisions in our life. Different things become important to us because we understand things differently. So what is it that we see? This is the development of wisdom. What is it that we see that is so transformative? Well, in insight practice, of course, we see the nature of the mind, we see the nature of the body, and we see how they interact with each other. The mind and the body are talking to each other all day long. When the body's uncomfortable, the mind has its reaction. When the mind is at ease and comfortable, the body has its reaction. And it goes like that all the time. But there's something more to be seen than just the taste of each moment's experience. And this is where insight occurs. We see moment by moment that whatever we experience comes into being of its own accord, lasts for a while, we can taste it, and then it disappears. It falls apart. It dissolves. It's impermanent. And we see it again and again and again. And in time, we see it with every experience. It arises, it's experienced, and passes away. Nothing lasts. We can see impermanence, but we may not realize impermanence. Insight is the realization that all conditioned things are impermanent. And when we see things deeply, when we understand things in this way deeply, we can't pretend otherwise. And so we live our life out of the understanding that this is impermanence. This won't last. This doesn't last. That's a powerful conditioning or deconditioning of our habits that we've learned from mom and dad and government. You know, get secure. Get whatever you can, hold on to it, don't let go, and you'll be secure. Whether it's education or a lot of money or a big house or a stable relationship or a family or the government that you want, or get it, keep it, hold on, because that's the way to be happy. Right? You know, insight will tell you something else. That's the first of the insights. The second insight is to understand that whatever arises, some of it's painful. Some of it's pleasurable. But the pleasurable experiences, whether it's pleasurable, sensually pleasurable, like it just feels comfortable, or whether it's financially pleasurable, or whether it's emotionally pleasurable, or whether it's socially pleasurable, it's unstable. It doesn't last. You can't rely on it. The third quality of this characteristic of dukkha is if it's not painful and it's changing, it can sometimes feel oppressive. Now, what I mean is, you know, we have these six sense doors, or we have the five familiar sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and we have the mind. You cannot shut them off. You can't shut off your ears. You can't shut off your eyes. You can close your eyes, but you'll still see visions, things that you've seen before. You can't certainly shut off the feeling of sensations in the body. And you know about the thoughts and the chatter of the mind. At some point in your practice of awareness and being finely attuned to what's actually going on, this incessant stimulation of the sense doors becomes oppressive. Now, when we have these understandings, things are impermanent, they're painful, or they're unchangeable, or they're oppressive, and they arise due to conditions outside of our immediate control, what is it that you're going to seek to hold on to for the security and stability of happiness in your life? Nothing. You see that it's not possible. Because you see these inner characteristics, these three universal characteristics of all phenomena. This is the practice of insight. This changes our way of understanding. It changes it, and initially it might be disappointment, and we might be very frustrated, we might be fearful, we might be disillusioned, we might be just kind of overwhelmed, but it's the key. These insights are the key to peace. Because when the mind is at ease with these understandings, when the mind comes to see, oh, this is the way it is, and accepts and acknowledges the facts, then we stop struggling with the way things are. And when we stop struggling and we have these understandings and we're not holding on and we're not expecting and we're not hanging on to a sense of entitlement about anything, it is possible then for the mind to fall into the unconditioned. The unconditioned is nibbana. The Buddha taught nibbana is peaceful. It has the characteristics of peace. It's the only secure place for where the mind can be at ease. It's not beyond you. Sometimes we think, oh yeah, well that's for the Buddha, that's for those monks and nuns at the time of the Buddha, that's for people who live in caves for all their life, or that's for people who live over there then. That's not true. It's available to Western lay people just like yourself. It's an understanding. It's not a lifestyle. It's the awareness that will reveal these understandings. Peace is possible. Don't be satisfied with anything less. This is the lesson of these five spiritual faculties. They're muscles to be developed. We all have these muscles. We all can develop them. And there is a reason, there's a goal, there's a direction that we're going, and it is towards peace. When your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities will change as well. And through such understanding, you will naturally practice more, and this will help you to do well in life. This is Saito Tejaniya's comment. So let's just sit for a minute and let the words quiet down. When your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities will change as well. And through such understanding, you'll naturally practice more, and this will help you to do well in life. So thank you for listening to the Dharma. There's a few minutes. If you have any comments or question, I'd be happy to try to respond. Yeah. Can you speak up a little bit? Yes.
So are you saying that conditioned phenomena are not created by cause and effect, that they have their own intrinsic
community? No. In fact, I'm not saying that things have their own nature to arise, but I'm saying that due to causes and conditions, they will arise. You know, all things are conditioned. All experiences are conditioned. And most of the conditions are outside of our control. So sometimes we don't see the causes and conditions that are giving rise to this experience. We just see that it has arisen due to its own nature, due to its own causes and conditions. And then we experience it as this is how it is. It has its own flavor. It's also conditioned. That's right. Anything else? I think, is there some announcements, Jerry, that we should? It's about closing time. We don't want to keep the shop open too late.